trustees of the Manx Museum and National Trust, and on behalf of the staff, welcome you tonight to this, the last of this present session of our special Friday night lectures. We're very pleased indeed to welcome as our speaker this evening Professor Trevor Norton, who is at what we all used to think of as the Marine Biology Station at Port Erin, but now in its centenary year, I'm told I must refer to as the Port Erin Marine Laboratory. Professor Norton is one of our trustees. He is also the organizer of the exhibition, which is on display at the moment in the temporary exhibition gallery. I shall resist the temptation to say that this is a misnomer and that it's actually a permanent gallery for showing temporary exhibitions. Professor Norton is, as I say, Professor of Marine Biology at Liverpool University and Director of the Port Erin Marine Laboratory, and has been since 1983. He was formerly Regius Professor of Marine Biology at the University of Bergen in Norway and titular professor at Glasgow University. He's a Fulbright Hayes Fellow, visiting professor at the University of Washington in America, University of California at Santa Barbara, the Suez Canal University, Egypt, and the University of the Philippines in the Visayas. It does seem that marine biologists get about a bit, does it not? He's a former president of the British Phycological Society. And for those of you who don't know what phycology is, it's the study of seaweeds. He's the ex-chairman of the Aquatic Life Sciences for the National Environment Research Council, which gives the research grants in aquatic biology and ecology. Amongst other things, he's also on the Executive Council of the International Phycological Society, the British Phycological Society, and the Marine Biology Association of the UK. And as I mentioned before, most importantly, he is a very valued member of the Manx Museum and National Trust. He's authored 150 publications, mostly on marine ecology. He has a wife and two children, and we are very glad, pardon me, to welcome his wife here tonight. The title of his talk this evening is Plumbing the Depths, 100 Years of Manx Marine Biology. So may I, on your behalf, extend a sincere and warm welcome to Professor Trevor Norton. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Bernard. It's always nice to be the last lecturer in the season. It's always nice to end on a low note. I confess that I'm a little nervous here tonight, not because of the surprisingly large audience, but because I was here for the last lecture given by George Melly on surrealism. And so I'm terrified of showing a slide. So if when I press this button, we get a Groucho Marx film, just sit back and enjoy it. I guess, really, the problem is that I worry whether marine biologists don't have quite the right image. And certainly it does surprise me that after 100 years, I suspect most people on the Isle of Man still don't know what goes on at the Port Erin Lab. So the time has come to confess all. What are we doing here in the Isle of Man? And indeed, how do we come to the Isle of Man in the first place? And the person we have to blame or praise is, in fact, Sir William Herdman. Sir William was a quite outstanding man in very many ways. He was said of him he would galvanize people to do things that they otherwise would never have dreamt of doing. A bit like Joan Collins, I suspect. And in 1881, he was appointed the Professor of Natural History at the University of Liverpool, a post he held with great distinction for the next 40 years. But the thing that's most important about his job there, the thing he did that most influenced the Isle of Man, was that he formed a club, a sort of gentleman's club called the Liverpool Marine Biological Committee. And this committee was businessmen, scientists, amateur naturalists. And they had two aims. One was to study the biology of Liverpool Bay and the Irish Sea, and the other one was to set up a marine laboratory as a center for their studies. And that's exactly what they did. They put up a small laboratory, first of all, in Anglesey, well, in Puffin Island on the north coast of Wales, but then almost exactly 100 years ago in this June, it's our centenary this year, they set up a small laboratory in about the center of the sweep of Port Erin Bay. And here's the laboratory, and this is the laboratory, and they also had built a small aquarium, and it was built by the owner, Mr. Clegg, the owner of one of the large hotels. And they rented this for £15 a year from Mr. Clegg. Now, the lab wasn't ideal. It was extremely cozy. In fact, it was so cozy, it was probably the equivalent of a sort of scientific shoebox. And you can see that they were very cramped in here when all of the members were there. The other problem was it was far too close to high water, so that when the tide was very high, every beast that could slither or hop entered the lab. And apparently, you couldn't open a book or take the top off any jar without something leaping out at you. They had quite a clear ethos. You paid an annual subscription of 1 guinea, and for that, you got a table in the lab during the summer, and you got a pint of alcohol per week, presumably for pickling the specimens rather than the scientists. And indeed, it was very important that even when you went out on the shore, you made sure you took your alcohol with you, because it mightn't be there when you get back. Now, clearly they couldn't do all their work on the shore, just wandering around. They needed a ship in which to do it. So they clubbed together and they bought themselves a research vessel. It was called the Shell Bend. It was a sort of hollowed out wooden banana. Worse still, it was a folding hollowed out wooden banana. And apparently it had a propensity for folding whilst at sea. So clearly it was not the vessel for doing business in great waters. And indeed, they couldn't sustain this level of investment, of course. So when they were doing work far out at sea, they had to hitch a lift. And one of the vessels in which they hitched lift most frequently was a boat called the Hyena. And this is the only picture I can find of the Hyena. Now, the Hyena is actually quite an interesting ship. She was a heavily armored gunboat which was used by General Gordon, the chap who went for his holidays to Khartoum and afraid never came back. He was during the Boxer Rebellion. This was the a boat that was sent up the Yangtze Kiang, and it would just launch itself at sandbanks, and it had enormous guns on board, and it could just blast the local forts into smithereens. And it came back, apparently, its exploits completely covered in glory and presumably quite a bit of dust and debris from the forts as well. And this was the boat that, in its more genteel retirement, found itself working for the Liverpool Salvage Association. And it was in that connection that the Liverpool Committee were able to hitch a ride and do their marine biology. It wasn't the ideal ship. It was designed really for shallow water, therefore it was a very shallow draft vessel, and that meant that it rolled and rocked violently even when it was in dock. It was called the Liverpool Greyhound because its maximum speed was only 3 knots. And that meant that there was a head current. It could go full steam ahead, backwards. However, it was extremely sturdily built because, of course, it was heavily armor-plated. And in fact, on one occasion, one of the scientists saw that they were heading for the reef. And he said to the captain, "Captain, we're heading for the rocks." And the captain merely said, "So much the worse for the rocks." It was really very difficult for the scientists. The boat didn't go the right speed. It didn't go to the right places. It didn't stop often enough for them to get their samples. In fact, poor old Herdman was so frustrated that once on a long journey when they did a trip out into the Atlantic, not on this boat, a different one, He wrote in his diary very frustratedly, fortunately, one of the crew died. Presumably not fortunate for the member of crew who died, but it was fortunate because they decided they would bury him at sea, which meant the ship would actually stop, and it would stop in a place where the scientists wanted to take their samples. And so whilst the poor crew member was being committed to the deep over one side of the ship, the scientists were putting down all their apparatus over the other side to take samples, and hoping against hope they didn't snag the body and drag him back on board. So clearly this was not an ideal arrangement. It called for drastic measures, and so Herdman took them. He married a shipping heiress. And she supplied him with the most beautiful set of steam yachts, of which this is just one. This is the Lady Bird, and here it is in Port Erin Bay. And for many, many years, Herdman used these yachts for the scientific work of the laboratory. In fact, obviously the Isle of Man hasn't altered a bit because there was so much gossip about him using these boats, he took out a full-page advert in the local papers which said, contrary to local gossip, I am not using the laboratory's boats for my own pleasure, I am using my private ship and giving its services free to the laboratory. So he had to put everyone straight. Now, the interesting corollary to this story is that I found out what shipping firm the heiress, Mrs. Herdman, actually was a member of, whose family she was a member. And I wrote to them and I said that, did you realize that your great-grandmother and I were related? And I told them the story of Herdman and how she bought him these beautiful steam yachts. And I said, I'm about to buy a beautiful steam yacht for the laboratory. And they sent me a check for £25,000 by return. Presumably for my cheek, I suspect. So I got £25,000. All I needed was another £800,000, and I could buy the ship that we bought last year, which is the research vessel Rogan. This is our new research vessel. It's, apart from the ferries, it must be the biggest vessel that's operating from the island. It's by far the biggest and most sophisticated ship that we've ever had at the Marine Lab, and it really does equip us for working in the 21st century. And what we're doing now, I mean, this is quite remarkable. This is the first major research vessel bought by a British university in 25 years. Quite amazing. And the last one, in fact, was built here on the island. It's the one that's used by the University of North Wales in Bangor. And now what we're doing, we're spending another almost £200,000 converting some of the interior of the ship into proper laboratory space for the sorts of work that we do. So there'll be a small collection at the end of the lecture. Meanwhile, let's go back 100 years, back to this little laboratory. It was obviously too small for their requirements. And so they needed a new premises, and with some financial help from the Isle of Man government, they managed to build themselves a new, this is the committee, build themselves a new laboratory in the site of the current laboratory. And this was in 1902. They tried to run it as a club as they had before, but it was really far too expensive to run like that. So what they did was to get it taken over by the University of Liverpool. And the university has been responsible financially for the laboratory since 1919. Since then, of course, we've built on extension after extension. It's now at least 8 and probably 10 times larger than it was in those days. Now, originally it had, and indeed still has, 4 functions. And the first one you can see here, it was a public aquarium. And in fact, it was deemed to be a public aquarium by Act of Tynwald. And this is the aquarium, how it looked originally. And if you look carefully back here, you'll see the tanks are exactly the same tanks as they were last year, when sadly we had to close the aquarium. The reason we closed the aquarium was because we felt that this was an Edwardian prison for fish and crabs, and it really wasn't up to the sorts of standards that are expected as minimal today. And we felt we couldn't continue with an aquarium that we were actually ashamed of. And that was the sad reason why it was closed. The good news is that thanks to a generous grant from the Calf Conservation Trust, we will be reopening the outer foyer part of the aquarium in about 6 weeks' time. It's been refurbished, it's got new lighting, it's going to have new displays, So it will be open again to the public. The trouble is, it was very difficult. Although it was kept open by Act of Tynwald, there was no grant from Tynwald, no funding for it. And in fact, we were not permitted by the Act to charge more than 6 old pence as an entrance fee. So it was financially very, very difficult to run it. However, I have now drawn up plans for a new aquarium. These have been costed, and I also have a company on the island who is interested in putting a substantial amount of money into the project. If I can also persuade the Department of Tourism that we need an aquarium on the island, then we might well open a new aquarium, one we would be proud of, next spring. That's my hope. So the first thing was to have a public aquarium. The second thing was teaching. That was always important. Although the station was an outpost of Liverpool University, it did hold classes. And this is the oceanography class of 1910. The classes now are bigger and not quite so genteel looking, and you'll see them mostly actually getting their feet wet on the beach. We now have, from 1972, we have been a full teaching department of the university. And we do all our teaching here on the Isle of Man, not in Liverpool. So the students come to us, we don't go to them. And in a given year, we have somewhere between 180 and 200 students coming here from the university for classes. And about 30 of those are here for the whole of their final year at university, even sitting their exams here. We have the earliest exams of any university department in Britain, because the exams have to finish before the TT, because the landladies tend to chuck the students out for better paying guests. We were the first department in Britain to offer a degree, in the British Isles, to offer a degree in marine biology. That was in 1972. We also have, in addition to these undergraduates, we have about 30 or so postgraduate students, people studying for their PhDs. These are people that are here from all over the world, and they're with us for completely for 3 years in order to get their doctorates. I've worked out that if we didn't call these people students, we called them visitors, our students alone are equivalent to 3,000 visitor weeks per year. That makes us, apart from the TT, the single most important attraction on the Isle of Man. Well, you might be wondering, what do all these students do when they leave us? Well, amazingly, most of them become marine biologists, or at least stay in biology. This is the last, I think it's the last 10 years of our students, but it gives you some idea that something like 60% of our students are actually going on to do higher degrees to stay in the subject, not necessarily with us, of course, they go to other universities to do this, and some of them go directly into jobs related to the subject. And many of the others actually go into related subjects. The others do almost anything else you care to mention. Some of them fall in love with the island or fall in love with girls on the island, and they become accountants, usually. So a public aquarium, teaching was another one of our main aims from the very beginning, one of our main jobs. And the third one was, in fact, a fish hatchery. The original building had within its walls a fish hatchery. And in those days, this was an incredibly unusual thing. And the reason it was unusual was because William Herdman was the British pioneer of aquaculture, the cultivation of fish and other things. Even in those days, there was a great deal of overfishing. And Herdman was convinced that nothing could be done to arrest the decline in fish stocks. The only thing you could do was to cultivate instead of fishing. And his logic went sort of like this. Most fish will produce thousands, if not millions, of eggs, but virtually none of those ever survive. They all die, and they die very, very early on in their life. Now, if only you could coax them, mollycoddle them over this very vulnerable early stage, you could then release them into the sea, and within a year or two, enormous numbers of gigantic fish would just be there for you to catch them. That was the theory, at least. It wasn't quite as simple as that in practice. So what he did was to design a place hatchery, a hatchery for place. Now, the marine biologists among you will notice this is not a hatchery for place. However, it is the place of a place hatchery. And what I mean by that is what Herdman planned was that he would take a part of the shore at Port Erin, he would build a large concrete wall, and he would dam in the water so he'd get a large swimming pool. Now, for reasons I don't want to go into now, that plan fell through. But his dam would have been on exactly the same site as someone did actually much later build a wall and build the swimming pool at Port Erin, the outdoor pool. And the ironic turn, you can see this is what the Isle of Man used to look like in the olden days when tourists came here. Isn't that amazing? And what happened was, the ironic twist was that long after the pool closed, it was taken over for a short period by an aquaculture company, and they did actually use this pond for cultivation. And sadly, it is now defunct. It's now looking very, very sad and neglected. So, not content with not getting his hatchery where he wanted it, what Herdman did was to build some spawning ponds right beside the laboratory. These are two sort of large swimming pools right beside the laboratory, and these were for the spawning of plaice. And here's one of the mummy plaice, and here is Mr. Cregeen, I think his name was, who was the technician. And I don't know whether he's feeding the plaice or whether he's tickling it or talking nicely to it. I think he's feeding it, look, because here's the dog food here. And the idea was to have these large breeding females. They would release their eggs into the water, and then you could just simply scoop the eggs off with a net. And you would take these fish eggs into the laboratory where they would be grown. So here we are in the hatchery. You wear a hat in the hatchery, just like in church. And the idea was that you'd put the eggs into these boxes. Can you see these little boxes here? These are the boxes here, little rectangular boxes, which are immersed in huge water baths. There's no lid on the box, and there's a gauze bottom. And the idea is the water flows through the box and out the bottom, and it keeps it well aerated, and the eggs are very healthy. Trouble is that the eggs all accumulate in one corner, at the downstream corner. And if they get too close together, they suffocate each other and they die. So you have to have some way of shaking the eggs, dispersing them. And you will notice that over this water bath, there is a gigantic beam, huge coat hanger, attached to hawsers and pulleys. Now, what happened was, at one end, where the water left the water baths, see, here are the baths here, and inside these are all these boxes, and they're attached. Every single box was attached at one corner to this enormous beam. And at one end, where the water goes out, there's a great big sort of coal scuttle thing. And as the water goes out here into the coal scuttle slowly descends towards the floor. And because of all these pulleys, it pulls up this enormous coat hanger. When the coal scuttle gets to the bottom of its traverse, it tips up, all the water goes all over the floor, the scuttle then shoots into the air, the coat hanger comes crashing down, and it frightens the life out of all the fish eggs. But it does disperse them a little as well. And this machine, this ingenious machine, was actually used to rock around the clock. It used to do this about every 2 minutes, and it did it without any kind of problems for 50 years without ceasing. So it was an incredible device, but it did work very successfully. And it did actually grow not only plaice, but lobsters and lots of other things, and grow them really quite successfully. One of the problems was they would grow perfectly good plaice, but when they weren't quite the right color. They were just the wrong color for plaice. And when they released them into the bay, that was the idea, they stuck out like a sore thumb. So the next day, all the predators were absolutely full of all these plaice they just put in the bay. So they were all eaten within about 2 or 3 days. However, that isn't quite the end of the story, because these sort of facilities and the ponds outside were also used for cultivating lots of other things. Lobsters, as I say, but also, believe it or not, oysters. Herdman did quite a bit of work on oysters, both in British waters and on the Isle of Man and in Ceylon, because the pearl oyster fishery is there. And here are some oysters being cultivated in Scotland. It's now a very, very big business. And in fact, the oyster industry owes everything to the experiments that were done here at Port Erin. All the major problems in cultivating oysters were sorted out here. But the interesting bit of the oyster story is that in order to grow the oysters, they had to feed them. And you feed oysters on tiny little plankton cells. And they asked one of the staff, a lady called Mamie Park, if she would cultivate the little cells as food for the oysters. So she said, I'll go to the sea, I'll get some samples of these tiny plankton cells, and then I'll cultivate, I'll choose the best ones, and I'll cultivate them up till we've got a stack of them, and then they'll do as food for the oysters. Much to her dismay, she found that she couldn't identify any of these little cells that she brought in. Many of them were actually new to science. They'd never been seen before, at least never been recognized before. So she did the job, as she said, and she fed the oysters, and that was a great success. But what she also did was to become fascinated by these little planktonic plants. And in fact, for many, many years, for the whole rest of her working life, long after she'd left Port Erin, she was still working on them. She became the authority on the world on these plants, and indeed became a fellow of the Royal Society for her trouble. So she never worked on oysters again. She worked not on the oysters, but on the oyster food. And it made her famous. Now, when Herdman died, most of this work stopped. But then in 1960, in Lowestoft, the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries were trying also to grow plaice and not having any success at all. And they remembered suddenly Herdman's spawning ponds in the Isle of Man. Well, I don't think there was a Herdman for spawning, but Herdman's ponds on the Isle of Man. Although if half the stories about Herdman are true, then there might have well been Herdman's spawning ponds. So they remembered these ponds on the Isle of Man, and so they came over to the island, they built a new extension to the marine lab, and in collaboration with some of the staff at that time, particularly Alan Bowers, who sadly died last year, they actually started growing plaice again, and this time very successfully indeed. Within a year, they'd got 100% survival of all the eggs they grew. Within 5 years, they were breeding something like 500,000 plaice per year. And they even had tasting panels where people had to taste blindfold, taste the cultivated plaice, and compare it with the ones picked from Port Erin Bay this morning to see which was the nicest. And they held up very well. They were very tasty. And the work was a great success. In fact, it was so successful that it more or less solved all the problems, the major problems that there were to cultivating flatfish. And so now in the world, there's a $1 billion industry based very largely on the work that was done here at Port Erin by that group in the 60s. And of course, there's also a turbot farm here on the Isle of Man. Now, our aquaculture work continues, not only on fish, but also on shellfish, particularly scallops. We cultivate scallops at Port Erin. Also tropical prawns, believe it or not, we've cultivated. Tropical fish, not for fish tanks, but for food in the tropics. And perhaps the most unusual crop of all, this is just the cultivation facilities in the 60s that put up by the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries. And this is the unusual crop, it's seaweed. One doesn't think of seaweed as being a very important crop, but there is no crop on the Isle of Man that's anything like as valuable. One species of seaweed that is cultivated in Japan, that crop alone is worth $1 billion per year. That's for human food. Here is Dibbles the gardener hanging the plants on the line, and here's the farm when the plants are a little older. These plants were originally grown for biomass, for making energy to replace gas and oil and so on, and then some of our students went into business by themselves to actually grow them for human food. The idea of this was to find out whether in the rather turbulent waters of the Isle of Man, whether you could still have a flimsy farm made of a cobweb of ropes on which to grow things like seaweeds. And in fact, it proved very successful indeed. We can, in fact, do it. Now, the fourth thing that they did was the scientific research, not the applied research, the aquaculture, but the other scientific research, and that was important from the very beginning. But of course, in the very beginning, in the old days, 100 years ago, most scientific research tended to be, in biology, identification and classification, because we didn't know what many of the animals and plants were. Nowadays, of course, we do very little of that, much, much less than we did, but we still managed to publish on the total of our work at the Port Erin Lab. Last year, we published 70 scientific publications. That makes us, by far, I would think, the biggest publisher of anything, in, except possibly the government, on the island. 70 publications last year. Sorry. Now, in the old days, it was mostly systematics and taxonomy. We still do a little bit of that, but mostly on animals and plants that live in rather obscure places. These crabs come from the very deep ocean. They don't live in anything like as shallow as the Irish Sea. They're found in the deepest troughs of the Atlantic. If you wanted to catch one of these crabs, you would have to, it would take you about 2 hours to put your sampler down to the bottom of the sea. And once you'd caught them, it would take you about 2 hours to winch it back because it's so deep. And we've studied these deep sea crabs and have really now seen every single specimen of them that's ever been captured and have worked out their taxonomy and so on. So we do some work like this. Most of our work on identification isn't done by just looking at the animal or plant and describing it. Most of it's done these days by means of biochemical genetics. You've perhaps heard of DNA fingerprinting. Well, we do this sort of thing and things related to this. What it really means is you take a tiny, tiny sample, really microscopic sample of protein from the animal or plant, and then you can treat this chemically and electrically, and the protein spreads out into various components and makes a fingerprint. And this design, this pattern, is absolutely characteristic of a particular species. So if you have two organisms that look very, very similar, and you take these samples of protein, the sample of protein may tell you, I'm sorry, they're not similar, they're really very much more different than they look. We also know how fast these proteins change with time. So we can not only tell you that these are two different species, we can also tell you that they became different species 1 million years ago. That's when they first diverged. And in fact, we do a great deal of the one of my members of staff is in fact Britain's leading authority on some of these techniques as applied to the marine environment. And when we look at some groups are not very exciting, you might think, but can be very important ecologically. Let's take a group of worm-like things called nematenes. Don't look like very much, not something you'd like to have for a pet. These are just long bits of sort of licorice slime. And when I say long, I mean long. These are 5 or 10 meters long, these animals. So they're quite big. I mean, it would stretch easily from the stage here right to the projector. And they are very common on our beaches. But they've been ignored by biologists because they couldn't be identified. They were too difficult. Now, using these genetic techniques, we can identify them. We found dozens of new species. And so now we can actually do some work on them. And because they're abundant, they're probably ecologically very important and have until now been very neglected. But even some of the commonest animals and plants, which we always thought were one species, are now proving to be more than one species. So that's the taxonomic side. And I must emphasize that this sort of work of identifying, differentiating species is absolutely vital in biology. The species is the basic unit of biology. Just as a banker or an accountant must be able to distinguish between a British pound note and an Australian pound note, so too we must be able to identify our species. Otherwise, we can't do any work at all. Now, most of the staff at the department are, in fact, ecologists, environmental biologists. And, in fact, from the very beginning, some of them were all along. Herdman, for example, was very interested in plankton. And here he is with off Bradderhead with one of his fine mesh nets for collecting the plankton. Now, the plankton are these microscopic organisms that live in the surface waters of the sea. And the ones that we're particularly interested in are, in fact, really very, very tiny indeed. The phytoplankton, the animal parts are actually bigger than this. These are the plants of the sea. And these are very, very tiny. They're usually in beautiful glass boxes. Many of them are, not all. Many of them beautiful boxes of glass. Because, of course, they have to be transparent to let the light in their plants. But they want to be protected from grazers, so they have to have some armor plating around them. And glass is the ideal compromise. They are really delightful. If you want to see some nice ones, perhaps you should buy some of the stamps coming out later on next month, which are to mark our centenary, because one of the subjects of the stamps is, in fact, phytoplankton. These are very, very tiny. They're microscopic. But that didn't stop the Victorians actually spending their winter evenings arranging these tiny, tiny things in spirals and concentric circles and so on. And you can see, perhaps, I hope you can see from there, Each one of these is a different shaped glass box, each one a work of art in itself. So I don't know how long it would have taken. Remember, each one of these things, a pinpoint, would look gigantic on this slide. So how on earth they arranged them, I don't know. And how long it took them, I don't know. But of course, this is before the days of ITV, so there was nothing much else to do. The other interesting thing about many of these plankton cells is they're phosphorescent. So if you have a dark, overcast night, they will blink at you like lazy stars in the sea. And if you go diving at night, you can be completely swathed in a halo of this brilliant green phosphorescence. And it's these little creatures that do it. They also contain oil. Because they have to have light, they're plants, they have to float near the surface. They can't afford to sink into the dark. And so what they have is a tiny, tiny droplet of oil as a sort of life jacket to keep them at the surface. Now, the interesting thing about the oil is that when they die, they drop to the bottom of the sea. And eventually they get covered with sediment, the oil escapes and accumulates. And all the oil around the British Isles, what from now on we'll probably have to call Scotland's oil, is in fact oil that has escaped from these tiny, tiny diatom cells. That's what it is. So you can imagine how many of these things, which are microscopic, which have within them an even more microscopic droplet of oil, how many have to die and accumulate before you get a zillion gallons of oil in an oil field. Now, the importance of this plankton, it was discovered by Herdman. Herdman was the first person to show that in the spring, just as your garden comes to life and the grass begins to grow, so too in the sea, these plankton cells suddenly start to grow. Actually, they don't really grow in the sense of getting bigger. They can't. They're in a glass box. What they do is they split in two. One takes the lid and one takes the box. And one with the box makes a new lid, and the one with the lid makes a new box. So instead of having one cell, you've got two. They then split again. You've got four, you've got eight, you've got 16, and suddenly you've got a sea full of cells, millions and millions. Here we are off the north coast of the west coast of Scotland. This is Lewis and Harris. And here, a gigantic area of the sea, this stain, as seen from a satellite, is this bloom of plankton in the spring. And it's this enormous blossoming of life in the sea that you can see from space, which is the energy, the food of the sea. It's the thing that drives the sea. And that was a discovery of Herdman, the first one to find that. Now, all the things that feed at the surface will feed on this plankton, almost all of them. And one of the most important from the point of view of the Isle of Man was the herring. And it would be almost impossible to overestimate the importance of the herring to the history of the Isle of Man. In the 1880s, a quarter of the entire population of the Isle of Man was supported by the herring industry. It was that important. The sad thing is that 12 years later, the crop had plummeted by 85%. And one of the problems, because of overfishing, and one of the problems with the herring was that it was always a boom and bust economy. A couple of good years and some disastrous years, and then later on some good years and some disastrous years, and on it went. And this shows you the size of the industry. Here are the herring being barreled. They were salted and barreled on the sea, on the shore. And most of the island's harbours used to be clogged with herring boats. But even then, because of overfishing, the crop was very precarious. And eventually, it was supplanted by a more lucrative crop, which was scallops and queenies. And the interesting thing about scallops and queenies, although they live on the bottom of the sea, they too feed on phytoplankton. They suck the plankton out of the water. So again, they're directly dependent on this blossom in the spring. All the stocks on the island, and in fact all the stocks in most of the seas around the British Isles, are in fact overfished. And it doesn't matter what you look at. Here we're looking at scallops, I think, yes. Here we're looking at scallops. This is how much you catch for a given amount of fishing effort using a given amount of gear. And if you look here, we're in 1950, and if you look in Bradda, you can see we're getting quite a substantial crop. But then, very, very rapidly, it declines, and we're now at this very, very low ebb which is the continuing subsistence level, really, of the fishery. And it doesn't matter what site you look at. Here's the chickens, goes down like this. Here's Peel. These are different beds. And you see the decline because of fishing efficiency catching quite a lot of the crop. And what it means is to get the same amount you used to get, you simply can't get that. But in order to get a decent crop, a decent catch, you have to fish for much, much longer. You have to go much further afield. I'll come to that in a moment. And you get very few large ones, whether it's fish or scallops. You're getting mostly young ones because very few of them are being given time to grow up to be large. So you're catching them much earlier in their life, and you're getting much smaller animals. Now, it's no wonder these stocks are overfished, because just to take trawling alone, bottom trawling, it's estimated that the area that's trawled in the Irish Sea each year, the area that's trawled is equivalent to 2.5 times the entire floor of the Irish Sea. So every bit on average is getting harvested 2.5 times. And it's estimated this takes about half of all the bottom feeding, bottom living fish every year. So it's a very substantial harvest. And that's just trawling, because of course for scallops you go dredging. And here are the dredges. And of course nowadays, instead of being one or two over the side of the ship, there are gangs of them on rollers here, perhaps 5 or 6 on each side of the ship. So you're actually dredging an area about the size of a motorway as you go along. And so it's very difficult for animals to escape, especially animals which are essentially non-mobile, like a scallop. So what are we doing about it? Well, one of the things that we do, perhaps I'll just show you the next slide before I go on, in order to get the crops, year by year, of course, what happened was the fishermen would go further. You'd get a good living close inshore originally, but then, of course, you had to go further and further away and further and further away and further and further away and spend much more time at sea to get less and less and less. Now, what we're doing about it, we monitor the stocks. And the way in which we monitor the stocks mostly nowadays is sonically. Remember these old 1940s movies where you were listening for submarines? It went ping, ping, ping. Well, a sophisticated development of that is the sonar that's used both by fishing boats and even more sophisticated form by research vessels. You send a sound signal down and it bounces back, and a computer interprets what the signal is. And what we have here is the bottom of the sea, the surface is up here, and all this cloud here is in fact a school of fish. Now, as we go across with a sophisticated sonar, that sonar will automatically count every single fish you go over, it will measure every single fish you go over, and it will even estimate the volume, the size of the fish. And all I've got to do is press a button on the computer, and it will give me a graph telling me how many young fish there are, how many older fish there are, and so on. And this can all be done very, very quickly without having to catch any fish at all. We catch a small sample to make sure we're right about the species, but that's all we do. So now we have to catch far fewer animals than we did 20 years ago, because electronic devices can give us a great deal of information. We also have various tag and recapture experiments. We can actually label some animals. Here's a scallop that's been labeled. It's got a number on it. And that label means we know that individual scallop. We can put it in the sea. There's a reward for a fisherman who brings it back, having caught it. And we can tell lots of things from the proportion that are caught and not caught. We can see whether they can move very much by where they were found, and so on and so on. We also issue to the fishermen logbooks, so that many fishermen on the island fill in exactly what was caught, when and where, and they submit that to the department, and we give them a sort of salary in exchange for doing that work. They wouldn't do this for the Isle of Man government, for the ministry, because, of course, they didn't know how the information was going to be used, and they will do it for us because we promise them that nothing individually from their catches and their boat will go back to the minister, only the processed data for all the information we get from all the logbooks. And so this way we're able to get a tremendous amount of information about the fisheries, far more than is often gathered by the British Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries. And of course, one of our jobs is indeed to advise the government on all matters connected with fisheries. And we must remember that now we've got an extended territorial waters. It's gone from 3 miles to out here to 12 miles. We've got an enormously larger area, which is, as it were, Manx territorial domain. And so there is a tremendous responsibility on the Isle of Man government to make sure that this is properly controlled, and also a big responsibility on the Marine Laboratory to make sure the government is supplied with the appropriate information to make the right decisions. And in fact, if it had not been for the presence of fishery scientists here in Port Erin, we would never have had this extension of territorial waters, because the British government would not have allowed it without the scientific backup that we provide. We also, because it's not just a matter of advising the British government, we are also advising the Isle of Man government, it's also we are the link between the Isle of Man and the European community, because all the fisheries law that governs all the waters is fixed in Europe. It's not fixed by the British government. It's fixed in Europe. And each year my colleagues go to Copenhagen to discuss the catches, the quotas and so on, and their findings are passed on through a committee to the Council of Ministers in Europe, and they set the fishery quotas for the whole of the waters around the British Isles, and indeed all the waters around Europe. So we are the link to the European community via other scientists. Also being on the Isle of Man gives us special advantages. For example, we have at the moment a protected area, a small area, a kilometre by a kilometre, off Port Erin, in which there is no fishing. And the purpose of this is severalfold. One is to find out, if you don't have any scallop fishing, how long does it take an area to recover from having been heavily fished? We're also growing scallops, so part of the area we're reseeding with scallops to see if we can hurry matters along. And also, by having an area in which there's no fishing, we can see whether scallop dredging actually does damage the bottom, because there is a lot of dispute at the moment whether it does or it does not damage the bottom. And if we have an area where there is no scallop dredging, we can compare that area with an area that is